morning. This is Hugh LaFollette, your host for Ideas and Issues. On our program this week, I'm talking with Arkan Fung, Assistant Professor of Public Policy at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University, and we're discussing Roberto Mangabeira's Unger's book, Democracy Realized. Arkan, glad to have you on the show.
Oh, I'm pleased to be here. Thank you for inviting me. I
wonder if you could begin by giving the listener a brief summary of the main themes developed by Unger in his book, Democracy Realized.
Yeah, as I read the book, one of Unger's main contributions is to explain how freedom is an extremely important value, a political value, that has been ignored or at least not stressed strongly enough by the progressive left in favor of equality. And so he wants to develop a political vision that in which ordinary people, can realize their political freedom to a much greater degree. So that's one important theme. And then the book is largely a book about how the economy can be restructured in ways that overcome deep kinds of inequalities. And unlike many progressive authors, he stresses that the key to this is to make sure that that everyone has access to the technologies and the methods of participating in what he calls the vanguard, that is the most productive part of the economy, and so that people aren't stuck in more or less dead end jobs and much less productive parts of the economy. And then a third theme that is really important in the book is the political treatment. He reads current political and constitutional structures in most of the world as freezing politics in place, that is sort of slowing down all efforts on any side for rapid change and the implementation of bold political programs. So he advocates a much more mobilized and quickened politics in which entire societies can change much more quickly through their political system. And then finally, all these things, the political view and the economic view and even the individual view, adds up to what he calls a democratic experimentalism. And the idea there is that democratic politics and society should be organized in a way so that people can experiment with different modes of economic production and different modes of political life. And he advocates a world in which there's much more economic, political, and social diversity than exists in the current world as he reads it.
Okay, I wonder if you could briefly summarize what you see as the main strengths of this book.
Yeah, you know, one main strength is that writing on the progressive academic left in law and sociology and political science these days is critical rather than constructive. Good progressive social theory has always had two moments in it. It's always had a critical moment that tells people what's wrong with the society that they live in and how the society that they live in isn't giving them respect and isn't advancing their interests and values. And then it's always also had a constructive moment that tells people how, at least in theory and hopefully in practice, they could move to a better social and political world. But these days, so much of the writing that we see is all critical and has very little of the constructive moment in it. But Roberto Unger's book, as with many of his previous works, is relentlessly constructive. It not only tells us what's wrong with the world in some detail, but tells us what a better world might look like in a very creative and inventive way, and then how we might get there. Another extremely important contribution of the book is to offer us a view of, for lack of a better term, political personality. That is, he offers us a view of what he thinks people are like and how current institutions don't allow them to realize that deep, in a way, essence. And he thinks that one of the most critical features of political personality is people's creativity. And so he thinks that one of the deep problems with our social and economic world today is that most of us anyway are living out other people's scripts and other people's routines rather than writing our own scripts and stories. And so he is after a set of political institutions that allows people in a very real way to be authors of their own lives. And he, for him, that's one of the most salient features of sort of political personhood and individual values that he wants to realize. And then a third real strength of the book is more general than his specific program. He offers this idea of revolutionary reform. And I think that this concept is very important for any deep social vision. And the idea here is that many reformers, whether on the right or the left, are thinking only about very small incremental changes to the current institutional modes. And he calls that view or that set of strategies reformist tinkering. And the idea there is it's not bad because you can make things a little bit better, but it's deeply limited because it leaves all of the flawed institutions that we have largely in place and just sort of tinkers on the edges, as it were. And he counterposes that to an older vision of politics, the revolutionary vision, in which proponents would seek to more or less replace wholesale all of the institutions that we have. For instance, the old socialist and communist visions of social revolution have an image like this in mind. And while that strategy is attractive in the sense that it aims at rectifying the deep structural problems that we have in society, it's oftentimes thought not to be very helpful because it has no roadmap to get from here to there. Unger offers this third idea that tries to combine elements of the two, and that idea, again, he calls revolutionary reform. And the idea there is we can think of step-by-step reforms that will be helpful but nevertheless lead to a deep transformation of the institutions that gets us out of this box that he calls reformist tinkering. And I think that is an extremely important idea because it says that we don't have to choose between being realistic and being true to our ideals.
Okay, what I'd like you to do, too, now is to look a little bit at what you might see as some of the weaknesses. And I know one of them actually has to do with that last point, that he argues that we ought to have a roadmap, but you're not so sure he provides it.
Yeah, he provides a roadmap in a sense. So the book has, and I encourage all of the listeners to have a close look at it if they haven't already, because it has a rich roadmap in the sense of providing a lot of detail about what kinds of institutions might be improvements and generate more freedom and also more equality along the way. So he talks about education programs and tax programs and different rules of property and credit that would allow many more people to participate in the entrepreneurial part of the economy. And then he also talks about various political reforms which would generate this kind of quickened politics that he discusses. But part of the roadmap that doesn't make complete sense to me, or at least is a silence, is that he doesn't really tell us who is going to start pressing for these reforms. And so I think that this is a weakness of the book insofar as it is a progressive program, because as good as these ideas are, they will not be advanced on the ground unless we can identify the actually existing political and social forces that might take an interest in implementing some of these institutions. So it's in one way, it's not exactly clear who Roberto Unger is addressing in this book. So, you know, maybe you might think that the most promising audiences are people in the big progressive movements like the environmental movement or the labor movement in the United States or other kinds of left-wing political movements around the world. But as I read those groupings, they would have a lot of resistance to this kind of political program because they're committed to a set of fights and a way of fighting that is embedded in the political institutions that we have already. It's the world that they know. It's the world that they're good, in which they have the capacities and skills to act with some felicity. So that is one kind of weakness of the book, is he doesn't tell us. He tells us in some detail what the steps are, but he doesn't really tell us, on my reading, who's going to take those steps or who's going to want to take those steps. Another issue of the book, I talked about this idea of political personality, and that I saw that as a strength of the book, but one might also see it as a weakness. So the ideal is kind of a heroic political person. It's deeply attractive in that he thinks every person, from the sort of most advantaged and most powerful to the most humble, ought to be the author of their own circumstances. And for him, that is that involves the making and breaking, the writing and rewriting of all kind of political and social rules. So it's a heroic vision of the ordinary person, and that's attractive because we think that people should be the masters of their own circumstances. But I wonder how broad of an audience that view really can address. I think that many people out there, including probably many of your readers and many of my colleagues, don't really want to be political heroes, but have much more modest ideals and desires, such as economic security, the desire to live a quiet but secure and maybe privately fulfilling and even sometimes publicly fulfilling life. So, you know, another ideal is one that Bill Clinton offered in his political campaign, which is that, you know, if you follow the rules, you should be able to do well. And, you know, what he was going to do is fix the rules so that deal was one that could stick. Unger is offering a much more dramatic vision of politics in which everyone participates in breaking the rules and rewriting better rules nearly all of the time. And, you know, there's a lot to be said for that. But, again, it may be too much of a heroic vision and too much of a romantic vision to have a very broad appeal and to capture what many people really consider important in a just political system.
Okay, I'm wondering if we can discuss some of those issues in a little more detail. For instance, one of the issues you raise is, does he tell us who's going to press for reform? Maybe I can actually ask the question this way. I mean, in your view, who is going to press for reform? How is reform going to be carried out? Is the power for pressing reform going to be in the hands of a small number of individuals, or do you see some sort of other mechanism that might lead to genuine reform?
I think that that's a very good and difficult question. I think the kinds of reforms that Roberto Unger is talking about in Democracy Realized are visible in very tiny ways. All over in many, many different areas of public life. So, you know, he takes off or he builds upon many developments that we see in the economy, right? So he has this vision of the vanguard and the rear guard, the vanguard being sort of what some people call high road production, right? That is, you can win economically by organizing your workforce and your production capabilities in ways that involve high skills and continuous improvement and highly educated workers. And one aspect of that is supposed to be that workers get very well paid as well. And then that contrasts with the rear guard or the backward part of the economy. Some people call that the low road, which means kind of low skill, low wage, labor intensive kinds of production that don't really rely on continuous innovation or learning, but kind of grunting it out. And so he observes that the economy is split in that way and then says, well, what a progressive vision should be about is making most of or all of the economy vanguard and none of it rear guard. Now, quite apart from whether or not you could actually do that, the general strategy of social theorizing there is a good one. That is to look at what some promising developments in the world and then ask how we could make those promising developments, which are oftentimes occurring only in isolated instances, more general. That is, whether or not it's possible to spread that kind of success. And you can see similar kinds of inventiveness and participation happening in many areas of public policy. So you look at community engagement or local involvement in education or many developments in participation in the environmental arena, and you see politics going in this experimentalist, more quickened, more participatory, maybe more deliberative way. And so I see one of the most promising routes to real change as taking getting people to take notice of these developments and what's good about them, and then pressing for their spread in for their much more general spread and diffusion. And there, the agents of political change are not the normal agents that we're familiar with. They're not the big political parties or big social movements or interest groups. There are people sort of out there in ordinary life trying to solve problems and then inventing in a very local way new ways of solving them that have pretty deep implications for how we do our politics and how we govern ourselves. Now, I think that those kinds of experiments and those kinds of initiatives will be pretty limited, both in terms of how many of them there are and how deeply they reach into our political and social life, unless different kinds of political actors take notice and decide that those kinds of strategies are also in their interest. And I think that that is quite a big challenge because, as I said before, I think that the large social movements and social movement organizations are reluctant to consider some of these new strategies because they're used to fighting in the old ways for kind of top-down rules and see some of these more participatory and decentralized initiatives as suspicious because they may smack of a kind of co-optation.
In fact, let me propose that that might be a good way of trying to cover the last third of the show is to look at one of those that you talk about in your own work, maybe briefly describe it, and then we can use it as a way of looking at the way in which you can have genuinely participatory and empowered democratic actions. One of them that you do discuss are some of the initiatives in Chicago with the school boards and with overseeing the police department. Maybe you could pick one of those and talk a little bit about it, what generated it, what made it possible, and what have been the strengths of these approaches.
Yeah, well, we could talk about either of those or a number of others in the environment. Let me talk a little bit about community policing in Chicago, because it's an interesting case both in terms of its successes and its weaknesses, in my view. And there, policing was basically reinvented in the mid-90s in Chicago. So every city in the United States, every police department in the United States, claims to be doing some version of community policing. But in Chicago, it's really a community-centered kind of community policing. And I view it as community-centered because unlike in many departments where community policing means you have one or two officers who get out of the car and walk the beat or ride on bicycles or go to community meetings every now and then, in Chicago, the community portions of the reform reach much more deep. So there, in every neighborhood in Chicago now, there are sort of monthly open meetings in which all of the police, or nearly all of them, who directly serve the neighborhood, participate, and then they're open to any resident to participate as well. And what goes on at those meetings is that residents and police talk together about what the most serious crime and public safety problems are in the neighborhood. And those what those discussions do is create the job of policing. They've basically reinvented what policing is about. It's no longer about, or it's no longer just about riding around in the car trying to deter crime before it happens and answering 911 calls. Now it's about the job of being a police officer is very much about solving, working on problems that are identified in this very participatory and deliberative process that occurs in these community policing meetings. And so that's a small example, a kernel of how problems in ordinary life, and in Chicago in the 80s it was, the problem was that the way that policing was done was not keeping the streets safe and was basically failing to address, the police were failing to deliver on their promise of securing social order and controlling violent crime in a bunch of these areas. And then what they did was they invented a new kind of political institution that devolves the job of deciding what police should do down to the very neighborhood level and invites ordinary citizens into a decision-making process in a very direct way over that. Now, the system overall has several kinds of difficulties, right? One kind of difficulty is that I believe that it is that these local meetings are oftentimes too controlled by city officials, and so oftentimes, especially in some poorer areas of Chicago, the police are less willing to cooperate with residents who participate in the meetings, try to control the meetings, and so on. And oftentimes, citizens are not well enough organized to counter that kind of domination and inequality. And then a second kind of problem is that this is a small reform and might count on Roberto Unger's view as a kind of reformist tinkering rather than a step toward revolutionary reform. So it doesn't really address a whole host of other problems, such as the root causes of crime or the very unjust incarceration policies that we and unjust and unconstructive incarceration policies that we have in the United States. I believe that this flavor of reform ought to, in the ideal, link up with people who are concerned with those other struggles around social justice and equality. The trouble is that people who fight those other fights, as I say, fight them in kind of the familiar ways of trying to mobilize a big top-down public policy change through a very adversarial kind of politics. So they see this kind of reform, this kind of participatory democratic policing, if you will, as maybe not that constructive of a step because it doesn't fit their ideas of how to win and how to fight political battles. So I think that that's a real challenge is to learn lessons from what's working in community policing and then also address some of the more conventional social movements and interest groups in showing them that this kind of strategy has the potential, at least, not to be just a co-opted kind of example, but also has the potential to lead to a deeper kind of participatory politics.
Okay, so this example, though, does exhibit several things that both Unger talks about and that you want to talk about when you talk about the possibility of reform. One is that certainly seems to be common, at least to both you and Unger, is that the participation occurs in some sort of decentralized way. It's not being done from the top down. It's being done in some important sense by the bottom up. And secondly, that it is partly because of that it's deeply participatory, that the ordinary person in the street has a say in what happens, has some control over what happens, or at least ideally has some control over what happens, their views count, and they're going to be the beneficiaries in some important sense of the decisions that are being made. Perhaps the one thing that's slightly different that you tend to emphasize a lot in your writing is that most real advances in government occur when there is something like a crisis, when something isn't going well, when something's awry, and people think there's a pressing need to deal with it. In the case of Chicago, that the the police simply weren't doing their job or the schools weren't doing their job. Am I right about that, that those are three important elements, two of which are perhaps comedy when Unger, and one which is maybe unique to you?
Yeah, I think that the first two elements definitely are common. In Unger's book, when he talks about politics, it's not so clear what the limits of participation are for him. So in some moments, you're absolutely right. He really does want ordinary people to participate in all these aspects of life. But then when he talks about large-scale political change, it seems like the agents that are doing the work are maybe more top-down agents. For instance, the leaders of social movement organizations or the leaders of political parties. So I think he's a little bit ambiguous there in terms of the constitution of bottom-up and what exactly that means. On this third point about sort of crisis and the reasons for participation, I think you're absolutely right. I think that many theorists and social scientists and others who come to this work on who are drawn to participation do hold a kind of classical ideal of participation. We like it because we think that it's important for ordinary people to participate in public life a lot of the time, and in particular a lot more than they're doing now. However, I'm kind of a realist about this. I think that when we think about actual institutions, you can only design institutions that elicit participation when people think that participating in politics will improve pretty tangible aspects of their life. So I think my own view is that we ought to have a kind of economy of participation, and we should only ask people to participate in public life and provide them opportunities to participate deeply in these direct ways when that participation does make contributions that sort of less expensive, less participatory ways can't deliver. So I think that in many school systems and many police departments and many areas of environmental regulation and caring for ecosystems and watersheds, that participatory mechanisms and participatory arrangements are the best way to do that job. That is what participation gets you, is a level of accountability and information that you just can't get through top-down arrangements. And so they should be organized in more participatory ways than they currently are. In many other areas of public life, for instance, some places the school system may be working just fine, or totally mundane areas like the collection of taxes or something, you probably wouldn't want to make those areas very participatory, because participation is costly for people. And if the system is working very well from the point of view of effectiveness and justice, then the rationale for participation, or much of the rationale for participation, I think, is much less compelling. So all this is just to say that we should be careful and targeted about what kinds of or where we urge political institutions to be more participatory, to avoid the problem, as Oscar Wilde said, that socialism's require, that the flaw with socialism is that it takes too many evenings of meetings.
Okay, well, thank you very much for appearing in the show today. I've been speaking to Arkan Fung, assistant professor at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. We've been discussing Roberto Mangabeira Unger's book, Democracy Realized. This is Hugo Fala, Fridays and Issues. Good day.